Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
À l'occasion de la journée de la santé mentale, découvrez En Off, un podcast de Shine qui donne la parole aux entrepreneurs sur leur santé mentale au travail. Ludovic, de Petit Bambou.
Il faut avoir une sacrée capacité à la joie. Parce qu'en fait, les parcours entrepreneuriaux, c'est pas des lignes droites, c'est des grandes sinusoïdes de grand bonheur et puis de grands doutes, de peur, de succès.
Dans le podcast En Off, produit par Shine, le compte qui libère le potentiel des pros, ils et elles racontent leurs parcours entrepreneuriaux, sans filtre. Shine vous invite à découvrir ce podcast sur vos plateformes d'écoute préférées.
Zoe Hocker est soudeur. Il se perfectionne dans le métaverse avec la plateforme de formation virtuelle de ForgeFX. Selon lui, la soudure virtuelle permet de s'entraîner autant qu'on le souhaite, d'améliorer ses compétences et de saisir des opportunités. Grâce à la Tulsa Welding School, Zoe et d'autres soudeurs peuvent utiliser la plateforme de ForgeFX pour renforcer leur expertise et répondre à la demande de travailleurs qualifiés dans le contexte économique actuel. Voilà comment des professionnels qualifiés utilisent le métaverse aujourd'hui.
Love Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 23rd of October, these are our main stories. Israel's military has maintained its intensified bombardment of the Gaza Strip. More aid is getting into Gaza, but the UN says it's nowhere near enough. Also in this podcast, Argentina's voters prove the opinion polls wrong and back a surprise candidate for the presidential election runoff next month. And researchers here in the UK say they've made a major breakthrough treating cervical cancer.
This is the biggest improvement that we've seen in this cancer in almost 25 years. Making those changes has really been what's made the difference.
After another night of Israeli aerial bombardment in Gaza, Hamas says the total number of people killed there has now passed 5,000. The group carried out the initial massacre of civilians in Israel 2 weeks ago, which killed more than 1,400 Israelis. Hamas, remember, is regarded as a terrorist organisation by the US, the UK and some other governments. In addition to those airstrikes overnight, Israel's military said today it had also conducted limited raids into Gaza to target gunmen and search for hostages. Daniel Hagari is a spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces.
During the night, there were raids by tank and infantry forces. These raids are raids that kill squads of terrorists who are preparing for the next stage in the war. These are raids that go deep to the contact line. These raids also locate and search for anything we can get in terms of intelligence on the missing and the hostages.
Well, late last night, staff and patients at a hospital in the southwest of Gaza were told to evacuate. Explosions were heard nearby shortly afterwards. Our correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf is in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza.
Another night of heavy bombardment in different areas, especially around the Al-Quds Hospital in a neighborhood called Tel El Hawa, southwest of Gaza, where Israel, for a couple of times, called the director of the hospital, asked them to evacuate. The director told me this morning that we have about 500 patients in the hospital and about 1,500 people who are taking the hospital as refuge. And he said, we decided not to leave the hospital. Last night, about 10 airstrikes within few meters of the hospital, maintaining more pressure on the people there to leave. Most of the building around the area were either destroyed or damaged. And also there was airstrikes overnight in Khan Yunis, where I am staying. About 4 people were killed in the overnight bombing. So non-stop shelling, non-stop airstrikes. They are bombing everywhere, in Rafah south, in the middle, in Nusayrat. We have seen airstrikes, so there is no safe place. Most Palestinians here are saying there is no safe place. So some of the people who left their homes, they returned back.
Rushdi Abu Alouf speaking from the south of Gaza. Well, more aid is entering Gaza. A third convoy of trucks has entered via the Rafah crossing, with around a dozen making the journey today from Egypt. But the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says at least 450 trucks every day is what's needed. I've been speaking to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Tom Bateman, about these various strands. And first, I asked him, what do we know about those Israeli overnight raids?
We don't know how effective they have been. There was at least one that we know of that was carried out in the early days of these hostilities, so they're not new. I think the assumption might be this kind of thing has probably been happening a fair amount, but we don't hear about most of it. But what we know today is that the Israeli military says that yesterday forces went in onto the other side of the fence, so they went west from the Israeli side into the Gaza Strip, and they said to clear an area of gunmen and weapons and to try to find information about hostages. Now, they say that missiles were then fired at their forces by Hamas, that one IDF soldier was killed and three others injured. Now, Hamas has also spoken about this, saying it happened east of Khan Yunis, a city in southern Gaza, and the Israeli soldiers crossed the fence, getting several metres in. They said they engaged with the Israelis, and they claim they destroyed two bulldozers and a tank before the Israeli soldiers fled. So clearly activity on the ground, but as I say, I don't think this is new, and these are very sort of limited incursions, it seems like, with a very sort of specific goal.
Can I ask you a little bit about the aid that is crossing again for the third day at Rafah from Egypt into Israel? I think a dozen or so trucks today, but the UN making it very clear that it doesn't think this is anywhere near enough.
It's making that extremely clear because, you know, we had around 20 on the first day, around 14 or 15 yesterday, and then a very limited number again today, carrying food, water, crucially, and medicines. But what we've heard from the UN is that on a normal day before the hostilities, that there will be hundreds of trucks of commodities entering Gaza. You know, now they're getting just a dozen, maybe maximum 20 per day in this incredibly challenging situation. And just to give you a sense of the crisis, the humanitarian crisis that is now gripping Gaza, I mean, people are being reduced in some cases to drinking saline or seawater. Some people drinking dirty agricultural water from wells, which may contain pesticides, at the same time that the hospitals are on their knees and there's a lack of even basic medicines.
And just finally, even though the Israeli government is telling people to leave the north of Gaza and head south, it's been doing that for some time now, it is the case, is it, that some of its airstrikes and other attacks continue in the south? It is targeting what it thinks is Hamas groups or affiliated groups in the south, where people are going.
Yeah, I mean, the airstrikes are all over. We were hearing from Rushdi Abu Alouf, our BBC colleague in Khan Yunis, in that city in the south. So it certainly seems there's no let-up at all in the south. There'd be many fatalities. I mean, in the whole of the Gaza Strip yesterday, according to health officials, more than 300 people killed. A considerable number of those are in the south. Israel, for its part, says in explanation to this that it will target Hamas wherever it knows it has infrastructure or facilities. And I think that's why we're seeing reports from the United Nations that some people are now simply going back to the north, because at least there they think that they might still have a home to go to.
Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. Well, before we move on from Israel and Gaza, here's a message from the newsroom's Jackie Leonard.
Hello, this is a request for your questions for our third special edition on what's going on in Israel and Gaza. We're getting together again with our colleagues from the Conflict podcast to try to bring some clarity to what is a very complex situation. Anything you want explaining, record us a voice message or simply write an email and send it to the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and we will put it to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, and other colleagues in the region covering the story. And don't forget, you can find the first two special Gaza-Israel editions of the Global News podcast wherever you found this one.
Thanks, Jackie. Argentina's voters appear to have proved the opinion polls there wrong. After the first round of voting in the presidential election at the weekend, it wasn't the populist right-wing Javier Milei, who brandished a chainsaw at one event, who came out on top. Instead, his rival Sergio Massa has taken the lead. With Argentina in a deep economic crisis, inflation there is over 100%. The contest is being viewed as one of the most important elections in decades. Our South America correspondent Katie Watson, who's in Buenos Aires, sent this report.
As the results came in, celebration. This, though, wasn't just a victory for Sergio Massa, but for all that came before him. People were waving flags and banging on drums with the famous faces of Peronism and Kirchnerism, the political movements that define Argentina.
Hundreds of people have gathered in the streets here, and many are waving blue and white flags on long bamboo poles. And it's a real Argentinian party here. There's lots of dancing. There's some steaks on the barbie in one corner right next to me. There are people here selling empanadas. And I think it's just a real party atmosphere here. This was the result that few people, no matter how committed they were to Sergio Massa winning, saw coming at all.
En nuestro país vive una situación compleja.
Our country is going through a complex and difficult situation, full of challenges and difficulties. I know that many of those who voted for us are the ones who are suffering the most. I will not fail them.
People might wonder how a man in charge of an economy with inflation running at 140% could win this. But this result says less about Massa and more about the alternatives.
What Massa showed and we showed is he's the only candidate that has a serious project for the country. Basically, the other candidates were like criticizing him, and they were like offering things that were like not possible.
This was definitely a plot twist in Argentina's election drama. Many people saw Javier Milei as the star of the show after his shock victory at the primaries 2 months ago. No longer, but he's not giving up.
Hace dos años.
2 years ago, if you had told us that we would be competing in a second round with Kirchnerism for the presidency of the nation, we would not have believed it. We really are witnessing a historic event.
When people went to vote on Sunday, the economic crisis was the main thing on their minds. Few believe, though, that politicians can solve it.
There are more and more millionaire politicians and people are getting poorer and poorer. We need to change that equation.
We have to really, really think about it, and we don't have a really good option. I didn't came here and said, I know who I'm going to vote. I was like, I don't really know, because nothing is, and I believe that nothing is good.
The party went on late into Sunday night. The hard work and campaigning starts again later this week. There'll be another month of uncertainty until Argentina chooses a new leader. What is clear, though, is that whoever wins this will have a huge job on their hands, turning around an economy and population in crisis.
Katie Watson reporting. Every 2 minutes, somewhere in the world, a woman dies of cervical cancer, more than 300,000 each year, 90% of whom are in low and middle income countries. There is some good news today, though. There are encouraging results from a British trial that used existing drugs to treat the cancer in a new way. Michelle Hussein spoke to Dr. Mary McCormack, who led the trial at University College London Hospitals.
We invited women to attend for chemotherapy once a week, half a day a week for 6 weeks before giving them the current standard treatment, which is daily radiotherapy with weekly chemo. So in effect, we gave additional chemotherapy for 6 weeks. With that approach, we found that when we looked at our progression-free survival, which is women that were alive without evidence of the cancer recurring at 5 years, at least 1 in 10 more patients alive in the group that had the additional chemotherapy. So 73% were alive and well without the cancer recurring, compared with 64% in the standard of care arm. And the important thing here is that if the patients are alive and well without the cancer recurring at 5 years, then they're very likely to be cured. So that's what makes this very exciting. And this is the biggest improvement that we've seen in this cancer in almost 25 years.
It is so interesting because you used existing drugs and you changed the sequence as well as bringing in that extra series of sessions of chemotherapy. What was it that made you think that that could yield a different result?
Well, there were some suggestions from trials that were done many years ago that giving chemotherapy before radiation might improve outcome, but the trials were very small and the results were conflicting. So we went back and looked at that again and thought, how can we make this better? And we can give the drugs every week instead of every 3 weeks. We can give it over a shorter period of time. In addition, one of the drugs, the paclitaxel, wasn't available sort of 25 years ago when all of those other trials were done. And we know that this is a very active drug and it's associated with a high response rate in cervical cancer. So we put this more active drug in, we gave the drugs every week, and we eliminated that big gap between the chemo and the radiation. So I think just making those changes has really been what's made the difference.
Dr. Mary McCormack with a little bit of good news about the treatment of cervical cancer. Still to come, the acoustic ecologist who's documenting wildlife habitats and the impact of humans.
Habitats that no longer exist. The animals have been poached. That whole herd that I had in the original recording is gone now.
À l'occasion de la journée de la santé mentale, découvrez En Off, un podcast de Shine qui donne la parole aux entrepreneurs sur leur santé mentale au travail. Ludovic, de Petit Bambou.
Il faut avoir une sacrée capacité à la joie. Parce qu'en fait, les parcours entrepreneuriaux, c'est pas des lignes droites, c'est des grandes sinusoïdes de grand bonheur et puis de grands doutes, de peur, de succès.
Dans le podcast En Off, produit par Shine, le compte qui libère le potentiel des pros, ils et elles racontent leurs parcours entrepreneuriaux, sans filtre. Shine vous invite à découvrir ce podcast sur vos plateformes d'écoute préférées.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to this podcast, the Global News Podcast. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is facing more criminal charges. A court has decided that he will stand trial on claims that he leaked classified documents that damaged the country's diplomatic relations. It was only a few months ago that he was convicted of corruption. His sentence for that was suspended, although he remained in prison, awaiting a decision on this new case. Our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis, is in Islamabad, and she told me more about the new charges.
Imran Khan and Shah Mahmood Qureshi, who was his foreign minister, so both former prime minister, former foreign minister, were both indicted today, which means, of course, that they are going to stand trial on these two charges. Now, the accusation is that Imran Khan leaked classified documents, and then subsequently, the second accusation is that that damaged diplomatic relations. This is all in relation to, it's been referred to as the Cipher case. So back in March 2022, Imran Khan appeared on stage at a rally waving a piece of paper, which he said contained evidence that there was a foreign power, there was a conspiracy against his government by a foreign power. And he said that the letter essentially detailed the fact that if Imran Khan was removed from power, that all would be forgiven. Those were the words that he used when describing what was in that letter. Now, the court and the authorities have now alleged that that means that Imran Khan has leaked classified information. If he is found guilty of doing that, there is a maximum sentence of 2 years. But importantly, the second charge is that that, as a result, damaged diplomatic relations. That has a maximum sentence of either life imprisonment or the death penalty.
At the time, did anything happen, though, or is this has only come to light relatively recently?
The case and the fact that Imran Khan was potentially going to be indicted or charged on this case, that's been a relatively recent case that's been brought forward. So the way that the court procedures work in Pakistan is that before people are officially charged or indicted for trial, there have to be documents presented. And Imran Khan is currently in prison in the build-up to this indictment in relation to this particular case. But no, this has been a relatively recent case. This has not been something that was brought up back in March 2022. This has been something that's been happening this year.
Quickly, just a reminder, so he's in jail for corruption, but he was going to be released, but he stayed in jail awaiting trial on these new charges.
So there's been lots of different court cases against Imran Khan. He was firstly put into jail in August, so just under 3 months ago. And that was when he was found guilty in the case that's referred to as the Toshakana case of not having correctly registered money he gained from selling state gifts. That sentence was then suspended, awaiting appeal, although it still technically stands. He's just not currently in prison on that case. But because he was also awaiting this decision about whether he was going to be indicted in what we've been referring to as the Cypher case, he was in prison waiting for that as well. So it's all quite confusing, but ultimately he is in prison, nearly been in prison for 3 months. And bear in mind that he's also disqualified for running from election, and the general elections are expected here in Pakistan in early next year.
Caroline Davies reporting. Now, here's a figure for you. Less than 2% of genetic information studied comes from people of African descent, and that has repercussions on medical research and treating people of African descent. To remedy this, scientists are planning a new initiative to collect genetic material from 500,000 African people to create what researchers believe will be the world's largest database of population genomic information. Kwasi Sarpong spoke to Anil Shankar of Mihari Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee, which is behind this study.
The first human population that emigrated out was from Northeast Africa. So in that respect, the human diaspora that exists on Earth today basically has some African ancestry. And that variation in this human diaspora, right now, we cannot study because we do not have the data set. So this reference genome data set from African ancestry population will allow us to study that.
It is quite shocking that less than 2% of DNA and genomics of people of African descent has been known. What has that been down to? Is it because people of that descent have been reluctant to provide that kind of data, or the scientific medical community has just been unable to gather that kind of data?
So it has been for two reasons. First, African people or African ancestry people or African Americans in the U.S. were not asked to participate in any studies that were done here. And so they are missing. And some of the historical mistrust created by, for example, the infamous syphilis study at Tuskegee University and the neighborhood of that university, that created a mistrust. So African people did not want to participate. But the younger generation understands that that is so crucial to advancing science. And that is crucial to discover treatments for African ancestry population, because they do not exist at this point of time. Or it is not clear if the treatments would work on them. For example, for diseases, we assess risk by polygenic risk score. And it is well established now that that is 25% accurate for African ancestry population, because all the standards and modeling was done on European ancestry population.
And if you're looking at gathering the data of about 500,000 people or volunteers, that's a lot of data. Who will own this data? How will this be managed?
We have established a new institute called the Diaspora Human Genomics Institute. So that institute will govern and store this data. And all those DHGI functions will be governed by an ethics committee. And the control will stay in the hands of people of African ancestry.
And how long would it take to collect this genetic material then?
For now, the goal is to complete this in the next 5 years.
Anil Shankar. Now, since the 1970s, Bernie Krause has made over 5,000 hours of sound recordings documenting wildlife habitats around the world. Many of those habitats have now fallen silent, victims of the shift in human activity. Our correspondent, Nicola Stanbridge, met Bernie Krause to talk about a new collaborative exhibition of his work here in London.
Descending into darkness at 180 Studios in London with sounds from the Senga Forest in the Central African Republic, captured by Louis Sarno, produced by acoustic ecologist and author of the great animal orchestra, Bernie Krause.
We had Western lowland gorilla, African grey parrots, Haddada ibis, greater spotted monkey, and Guinea turaco.
all brought flickering to life with hovering, glowing lines of light, an installation designed by United Visual Artists' Matt Clark.
On the floor is an array of small discrete speakers, and that's where the sounds of crickets, frogs, birds call from. And then there's also an outer array of speakers where you get wind, chainsaws in the distance, planes flying overhead. And really it's an interplay between the man-made noises and forests. The structure is meant to represent a kind of monument to nature, which we can orchestrate like a, it's like a sonic rewilding.
And as we hear the insects, you can see green light. It's very soothing, very calming. As you hear the airplanes going over, they turn white. They become quite brittle to the eye, actually, to look at.
And really, it sort of demonstrates, you know, we can live in harmony through the noise we make, but we can also disrupt nature.
Matt and his team have created an algorithm that allows you and the audience to see the sound and its effect.
Some of the recordings are the Bayaka tribe, who actually sort of make a lot of noise, music, but it's in harmony with the natural surroundings.
We learned orchestration, melody, rhythm, all of these things from the sounds of the natural world when we lived much more closely. So it's really an epic story of, you know, how these habitats are devastated by human endeavor. And the rainforest has been compromised because of extraction of hardwoods, habitats that no longer exist. The animals have been poached, like the elephants, for instance. That whole herd that I had in the original recording is gone now. In Louis' recordings, over time from 1984 to the time that he died, you can hear the sounds of the rainforest diminish.
And then there's one of your other famous sounds, over the doors. This is the end. When we watch Francis Ford Coppola's 1979 Apocalypse Now, which you created with Walter Murch and others.
I programmed the material for about a third of the score and did the helicopter sounds. I created that sound on the Moog synthesizer. My late music partner, Paul Beaver, and I had introduced the synthesizer to pop music and film in 1967. So here I am, funded by Coppola in that regard.
That report by Nicola Stanbridge. Now, let's end on a master of movement, mockery and music, all of it on film. Charlie Chaplin was probably the most famous man in the world at the high point of his prolific career in mostly silent movies, which started more than 100 years ago. Well, later this week, his cane and an outsized suit, which he wore to create the iconic tramp, will go up for auction in the north of England. Here's Wendy Urquhart.
Charlie Chaplin was an icon of the silent film era. He starred in 93 films and directed 72 of them, including The Kid, A Woman of Paris and The Great Dictator. His clothes, hat and cane and his penguin walk are as famous as his movies. Chaplin's parents were both music hall entertainers, so perhaps it's not surprising that he sought the limelight, but his route to stardom was far from easy. He grew up in abject poverty in London. His parents separated early on, and at the age of seven, he was sent to Lambeth Workhouse, a bleak institution providing work and shelter for the poor. Charlie's mum was later committed to an asylum, and he spent his childhood at a school for the destitute. It was around that time that he started performing on stage, and the showbiz contacts that his parents had made proved to be a lifeline, allowing him to tour music halls around England. But it was the famous suit that was several sizes too big that Charlie wore as the little tramp in the stage production of The Mumming Birds in California in 1910 that made him a household name. He borrowed the suit from fellow actor Billy Ritchie and returned it when the production ended. 4 years later, he reprised the role wearing a different suit in the Kid auto races at Venice, and he became a global phenomenon. When Billy Ritchie died in 1921, his widow gave the original suit, bowler hat and bamboo cane to the London stage doorman Harry Brown for his private museum. The cane was signed by Chaplin in 1952 and it's expected to sell for around $24,000 at auction. The original suit worn by Charlie Chaplin in his first ever portrayal of the Tramp is causing a real buzz in the auction world. But if you're thinking of bidding for one of the most iconic pieces of film memorabilia, be prepared to dig deep because it's estimated to rake in at least $145,000.
And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Dean and produced by Judy Frankel. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for being with us. Goodbye.
À l'occasion de la journée de la santé mentale, découvrez En Off, un podcast de Shine qui donne la parole aux entrepreneurs sur leur santé mentale au travail. Ludovic, de Petit Bambou.
Il faut avoir une sacrée capacité à la joie. Parce qu'en fait, les parcours entrepreneuriaux, c'est pas des lignes droites, c'est des grandes sinusoïdes, de grands bonheurs et puis de grands doutes, de peur, de succès.
Dans le podcast En Off, produit par Shine, le compte qui libère le potentiel des pros, ils et elles racontent leurs parcours entrepreneuriaux, sans filtre. Shine vous invite à découvrir ce podcast sur vos plateformes d'écoute préférées.